most tertiary hospitals, large hospitals in China are very crowded and overstretched, even during normal times.
The rush is on to build more hospitals in China. It's Friday, January 31st, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, the Wuhan coronavirus, officially now a public health emergency. The last day of Senate questions in the Trump impeachment trial, and the heart of soul food found in greens. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The latest number of confirmed cases of China's novel coronavirus sits at 7,700, including 170 deaths. Russia has closed parts of its border with China, and in the U.S., the first human-to-human infection has been documented. In short, things aren't good. And now the World Health Organization Emergency Committee has officially designated the new coronavirus as a public health emergency of international concern. Making that designation puts a legal responsibility on all UN member states to coordinate and enact certain health measures and also unlock extra funding to fight the outbreak. The two previous emergency meetings ended inconclusively, with WHO experts split on whether the spread of the coronavirus was large enough to constitute an international emergency. But this quickly evolving disease has apparently changed some of the doubters' minds. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The two previous emergency meetings ended inconclusively. WHO experts were split on whether the spread of the coronavirus was large enough to constitute a public health emergency of international concern. But this quickly evolving disease may change some of the doubters' minds. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus praises the strong response taken by the Chinese government to try to stop the epidemic. This includes the lockdown of Wuhan City, the epicenter of the disease, and other cities in the country where the virus has been identified. But he acknowledges that events on the ground in China and abroad are moving too quickly to be ignored. He says the emergence of any new pathogen with the potential to cause severe illness and death is of grave concern and must be taken with utmost seriousness.
The continued increase in cases and the evidence of human-to-human transmission outside China are, of course, both deeply concerning, although the numbers outside China are still relatively small. They hold the potential for a much larger outbreak.
So far, at least 70 cases of coronavirus have been found in more than a dozen countries, including the United States. All of these cases are being imported by travelers from China. An increasing number of countries are screening arriving passengers for infections and isolating them for the two-week incubation period. Executive Director of WHO Health Emergencies Program, Michael Ryan, says the situation is very fluid and changing by the hour. He says the whole world needs to be on the alert now and take whatever action is needed to stop transmission of this deadly virus.
We are at an important juncture in this event. We, as WHO, believe that these chains of transmission can still be interrupted. This disease is still spreading from person to person through personal contact between individuals.
Ryan says the epidemic can be stemmed through proper hygiene, proper identification of cases, isolation, and social distancing. He says the emergency committee will consider the merits of declaring a global public health emergency. He says the WHO experts are likely to recommend a series of temporary actions for countries to undertake in a coordinated, measured fashion. He says efforts to end an epidemic are always more effective when countries work together. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And we'll have more on this swiftly moving story later in our program. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. India police have detained a man who fired a shot near a university in New Delhi. Tokyo prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Nissan's former chairman, who skipped bail while awaiting trial in Japan. U.S. defense officials believe they have unmasked the Islamic State terror group's new leader, identifying him as Haji Abdallah. And a municipal appeals court in Phnom Penh has upheld a lower court ruling to continue investigating a pair of former Radio Free Asia reporters on espionage. Read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, plus the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues from Washington. The numbers of those infected with the Wuhan coronavirus are shocking, but they pale in comparison to those under quarantine in the region. Over 50 million people are under some form of lockdown, confined largely to their homes with occasional trips to get supplies. That's more than the entire population of South Korea. One of those stuck in Wuhan is Johnny Dangerfield, a finance manager from Arizona. Dangerfield, his wife, and three children are largely confined to their apartment, a situation that he says is getting old.
When we first came to Wuhan, I've noticed my concern about things has kind of risen and fallen, actually. When we first came to Wuhan, we were, at that point, things hadn't really exploded yet. There was just, 60 or so cases. That's why we decided to go ahead with our trip. And then with the lockdown, things got, our concern really started to rise. And then after, in the last couple of days, we've kind of settled into kind of a long-term, it's going to be okay mode. We're doing all right. So that's kind of the basics of our feelings. But as far as being in lockdown, I mean, it's kind of jarring to not to know that we couldn't leave if we wanted to. But we're with family here. My wife's from Wuhan, so we're actually feeling pretty comfortable despite the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So do you go outside? Like, how often do you go outside?
So we do go outside. In fact, I try to go outside at least every day, although we are spending most of our time indoors, mostly just to avoid public places and gatherings and things like that. But I like to run for exercise, and so I've still been going out to run a few times a week. We have young children, so it's important for us that they get some air or get the chance to stretch their legs or maybe run around a little bit. And so we try to take them out for walks a couple times a day. It's almost like they're seeming like pets at this point. We got to walk them, just because we are so measured kind of with going outside, just out of extra precaution.
What has changed outside on the street?
It's hard to tell. Uh-huh. We live on a college campus, and so it's already sort of an insulated environment from general Wuhan. And my understanding is that this time of year with the winter holiday and the Lunar New Year holiday, it can often be very, very quiet and around the place where we live. So we can, even on a normal year, we might be taking walks and not seeing many people. It's probably a little bit more quiet than normal, a little bit more empty out there. In general, it's still pretty quiet with the holiday, even on a normal year.
American expat Johnny Dangerfield speaking with VOA Mandarin's Adriana Zhang from his home in the city of Wuhan. Happening now in Asia, Russia and China are waging a digital war with fake news and disinformation to undermine democracy in Europe. The European Union must develop tools to fight back, so says a top EU official on Thursday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thanks so much for joining us on VOA Asia. A massive mobilization is underway in the city of Wuhan. Officials are racing to build two new medical centers from the ground up in just a matter of days. Wuhan is the epicenter for the spread of the new coronavirus that's flooding the country's healthcare system. Hospitals are overcrowded with sick people or those who think they may be sick. The new facilities aim to help carry the load. But experts say China's healthcare system faces long-term challenges. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Chinese state media shows an around-the-clock effort to build two new facilities, each with room for 1,000 patients or more.
Last night, the workers worked all through the night, and another shift of workers started to work at 2 a.m.
These scaled-down hospitals will concentrate solely on isolating and treating coronavirus patients. Prefabricated parts help construction go faster. The speed is impressive, says Johns Hopkins University senior scientist Eric Toner.
Well, I think it's remarkable that China can put together any sort of facility in such a short period of time. They did this in 2003 during SARS. They built a 1,000-bed facility in 6 or 7 days, and they're looks like they're actually doing it again.
The Chinese military helped build that facility outside Beijing. State media says it treated about 1 in 7 SARS patients and had a much lower death rate than other healthcare centers. Chinese officials say they are modeling the new centers on that experience. The facilities are badly needed, says Harvard University health policy professor Winnie Yip.
Most tertiary hospitals, large hospitals in China, are very crowded and overstretched, even during normal times. So during an epidemic, I can imagine that more beds are needed.
Yip says China has been focused on building big hospitals in urban centers, not community clinics that focus on prevention.
In the long run, China should build a stronger primary health care and public health system that would actually prevent something like this happening at large scale, and also people getting detected much earlier. But at this moment, the primary healthcare system in China is relatively weak.
Yip says the government is working to build up primary care, but that will take time. In the meantime,
China is actually sending teams of doctors and nurses from the military hospital system, of which China can quickly mobilize. And many other provinces and cities are also voluntarily sending their physicians to help.
And construction continues night and day as Wuhan aims to open 2 brand new coronavirus treatment centers next week. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
And you're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Authorities in Bangladesh will expand educational programs for hundreds of thousands of Muslim Rohingya children living in refugee camps, who are currently receiving only basic lessons, officials said on Wednesday. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The 100 senators weighing if U.S. President Donald Trump should be removed from office finally got the opportunity to ask their own questions this week. In the first of 2 days of a new phase of the Senate impeachment trial, senators followed up with House impeachment managers and the president's defense team on a range of legal issues relating to Trump's dealings with Ukraine. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
Outside the U.S. Capitol, protesters calling for more information. Part of the majority of the American public who say they want to see new evidence and testimony in the Senate impeachment trial, starting with former National Security Advisor John Bolton, a call supported by some Republican senators. Senator Mitt Romney, Republican.
John Bolton, for instance, may be able to tell us precisely when the decision was made not to provide the aid on an immediate basis to Ukraine and what the president's reasoning was at that point. I mean, these are questions that we've seen no evidence on at this stage, and I'd like to get that answer.
But it's still unclear if there will be enough Republican support for calling witnesses when that vote likely occurs this Friday. Republican Senator Susan Collins.
I have no idea how the votes are going to fall.
A decision Democrats say decides the ultimate fairness of the trial. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
Before there's a vote on conviction or acquittal, there's going to be a vote on whether this is a trial or a sham.
The question phase of the impeachment trial turned into a debate over allowing witnesses. Chief Justice John Roberts reading a senator's question.
Is there any way for the Senate to render a fully informed verdict in this case without hearing the testimony of Bolton, Mulvaney, and the other key eyewitnesses, or without seeing the relevant documentary evidence?
Democratic Congressman and House Impeachment Manager Adam Schiff.
The short answer to that question is no. There's no way to have a fair trial without witnesses.
But each side also got an opportunity to refine their argument against the impeachment of Trump and in support of it. Alan Dershowitz, Trump defense attorney.
President does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest. That cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
House Impeachment Manager Congressman Adam Schiff.
If you look at the pattern in this president's conduct and his words, what you see is a president who identifies the state as being himself.
Senators will have 8 more hours for questions Thursday, followed by the all-important decision on witnesses by the end of the week. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
As of airtime, senators have resumed questioning for the final day. Friday is expected to bring major votes determining where the trial goes from here. This news from VOA Asia. Human rights watchdog Amnesty International, in its annual report for Asia, has accused Pakistan of intensifying its crackdown on human rights, including a clampdown on freedom of expression and failure to control harassment of ethnic and religious minorities. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, according to the nonprofit group World's Children, an estimated 21 million people are victims of human trafficking. Many of them are undocumented Hispanic women who are hard to track because they often are afraid to seek help from authorities. VOA's Cristina Caicedo-Smith reports.
Undocumented Hispanic women in the United States can often be victims of human trafficking. Experts say because they live in the shadows to avoid being deported, they are easier prey for criminals.
Some of the cases we see are women who work as maids. The employer takes away their passport or hides it. They don't let them communicate with their family, and most of the victims we see are Hispanics.
Heidi Alvarez is the director of social services at SAFE, a University of Maryland initiative which supports victims of labor exploitation and human trafficking.
Sometimes people, if they are undocumented, are afraid to reach out to police. They are afraid to seek help.
According to a report by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, human trafficking generated $150 billion annually for criminal organizations during 2018. The National Helpline received more than 41,000 telephone calls.
When it comes to men, you'll see a lot of victims in the construction business or agriculture industries, while women we encounter mostly in, I would consider, domestic jobs and or illicit massage parlors or businesses.
Joe Geronimo, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security Investigations, underscores the point that immigrants without documents are more vulnerable.
That is an area that human trafficking organizations will exploit because of their vulnerability of being exposed to law enforcement because of their immigration status. Again, that is something they see as a weakness and again, we'll prey upon.
In Montgomery County, Maryland, which has a high Hispanic population, Local lawmakers say it is extremely important to talk about the issue.
To, you know, meet people who have been and beaten and drugged and forced to have sex or forced to perform labor against their will for months at a time or years at a time and a part of that life, they need a lot of support from us, and the public needs to become aware of the signs of it so they can bring it to the attention of our law enforcement and our county government.
Authorities also warn about the need to be careful with social media. They say many criminal gangs use online tools to promote non-existent jobs as a way to lure potential victims. Cristina Caicedo Smith, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Voyager 2 is considered the oldest and one of the most distant working spacecraft. Despite being over 42 years old, four of the spacecraft's scientific instruments are still working and transmitting data to scientists on Earth. On January 25th, Voyager reported that it didn't execute a scheduled maneuver, which led to events that triggered one of the spacecraft's fault protection routines. As a result, the spacecraft turned off its science instruments. A few days later, Voyager mission engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory managed to turn the science instruments back on, but they're still not gathering data. NASA says the engineers are working on resuming the spacecraft's normal operations. Voyager 2 and its sister Voyager 1 were launched in 1977 and are both in interstellar space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, it's been a rough week, so let's shift gears to close it out to a more appetizing story. What's now called soul food originally came out of Black culture in the southern United States. Now, at its core, soul food is a hearty, spicy food rich with calories and protein that African Americans needed to make it through the long days of hard work, first as slaves on plantations, and then after emancipation working as sharecroppers on farms in the rural South. But over time, soul food has become high cuisine, and it's at the heart of some great D.C. restaurants. VOA's Unshin Lin reports.
Even on a weekday, it is a busy scene at this restaurant on Washington's U Street. Customers line up for fried chicken, mac and cheese, candied yams, cornbread, what's known as soul food.
The soul food moniker came from in the 60s and 70s when we had the Black Power movement. And I mean, it was about having pride in your style of cuisine, putting your soul in it. And it fed, you know, the masses since 1700s or before that.
Located just a few blocks from the African-American Civil War Memorial, the Ooz and Oz restaurant is becoming the soul food hub of Washington, D.C.
We have a lot of excellent guests that have come here that might be famous. Jay-Z, LeBron James, J. Cole, he's comes in all the time.
But these dishes, which are traditional African-American home staples, are in fact enjoyed by everyone here.
I see that you guys order fried chicken and some green beans and there's mac and cheese. Which one is your favorite?
Definitely the fried chicken.
Yeah?
For sure.
Did you grow up with the food?
Yeah. So being from Texas, we ate a lot of soul food, fried chicken, waffles, green beans, cornbread, everything. But the fried chicken's awesome.
Award-winning chef Audrey Abbott started cooking at a young age, learning in the field through trial and error. And now, nothing makes him happier than seeing customers enjoying the recipe he got from his grandmother.
For everybody to know something about, you know, African-American history and some of the things that we went through, the success stories are more than, you know, just a few that you hear about, you know, sporadically.
And he hopes his story, as well as the recipe that carries a cultural and historic significance, keeps inspiring those who come to eat at his restaurant. Unshin Lee, VOA News, Washington.
I live about two blocks from Ooz and Oz, and I can testify it's some of the best food you're ever going to find in Washington, D.C. Well, that is our program for today and for this week. Thank you so much for being with us. We will be back with you again on Monday. We hope you will join us then as well. Until then, enjoy your weekend and be well.